You're listening to the Three Creeks Church podcast. We are currently in a series called Minor Prophets, where we are studying the books of Hosea, Joel, Amos, and Obadiah. These books were written to the nation of Israel after they had turned their back on God. They offer a plan of restoration through the coming Messiah, Jesus, who will heal and redeem what their sin had broken. The good news is this. If you want to know how to put a life back together or want to pursue healing in relationships that have been devastated by sin, these books are just for you.
Well, hey, Three Creeks Church, my name is Joel Trainer, and welcome back to Three Creeks Church Online. We're in week two of a brand new series that we have titled Minor Prophets Season 1, and today I'm going to be going through the book of Joel. Joel was a minor prophet. As I mentioned last week in our first week of the series, the only reason why these people are called minor prophets is just because they wrote less. This is the most obscure, least read, most difficult part of your Bible to understand. High likelihood that if you've ever tried to read the book of Joel, you thought, what is this guy talking about? And you skipped forward to the book of Matthew or Mark and found something that was a little bit more easily understood. These minor prophets, there's 12 of them. In this series, we're going through the first four, Hosea, Joel, Amos, and Obadiah. These guys are not less significant. They're not less important. That's not why they're called minor. They're called minor because they wrote less. They didn't talk as much. Some of you wish that I was a little bit more minor at times, not so long-winded. But these guys, they just got right to the point. The book of Joel is only 3 chapters long, 73 verses. The major prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, they wrote 40 or 50 chapters, but Joel's only 3. It's pretty short. It's still too much for me to go into detail in one message, which is one of the great things about this series is we have these dive deeper questions on the back of your community group guide. So if you want to know more about the book of Joel, there's parts of the book of Joel that I'm really not even going to talk about today, and significant parts. And if you would just take 10 or 15 minutes every day this week and answer those questions, you're going to know even more about this minor prophet named Joel. Let's turn there now. I might need to give you an extra minute because, like I said, these are the pages of the Bible that you just probably haven't gone to very much. They're the crispy white pages. Don't have a whole lot of markings on them. But let's go there now. Go to the book of Joel, and here's what I want you to do. As a group, I want you to pause this video, and I want you to read the whole thing. I did it this week. It took me 7 minutes. I'm an average reader. It's not going to take you too long. And I'll just tell you right now, as you get into chapter 2 and chapter 3, you're going to be going, what is this guy talking about? But as soon as we're done, come back to me and I'll explain the book of Joel in a little bit more detail. So pause this video, the book of Joel, take it away. All right, so you made it through the whole book of Joel, all 3 chapters. There's a lot of attacking. There's a lot of locusts. There's a lot of wine. Somebody loved that. There's a bride dressed in black. It's a little odd. There's 5 different mentions. I don't know if you caught it. 5 different mentions of something called the Day of the Lord. What does that mean? I'll just tell you right now, I'm actually not going to get into that part today, but if you want to know what it means, maybe you could jump into the dive deeper part. There's more to this book than I'm going to be able to share today. Without an understanding of Joel, without an understanding of prophets, without an understanding of Israel, and without an understanding of where this fits into the history of the world, it really is impossible to understand and, frankly, dangerous to apply. So let me just set the groundwork. Let me show you who this guy was and who he wrote to and why he did it so you can understand more about what Joel was writing. Prophets were people who spoke for God. So when God had something to say, he would use prophets to say it. Joel was one of the earliest prophets that ever wrote. In fact, in my opinion, the only one who wrote before him was Obadiah. We're going to do him in week 4, in 2 weeks from now. We're going to talk about Obadiah too, but that proves the point that the Old Testament is not all written in chronological order. It's not just a history book, you know, one chapter after another. The Old Testament is organized into different themes, and we're in this minor prophet theme towards the back of the Old Testament. But Joel was really written, to the best of my knowledge, right after Solomon was the king, but before the exile, before Babylon took them into exile. And Joel was written to the southern kingdom. The book of Joel is a warning, and the book of Joel is an invitation. Let me explain what I mean. Joel starts out in chapter 1 trying to get their attention. Look what he writes in verse 2. In all your history, has anything like this happened before? He writes right away, he's trying to get their attention. Has anything like this ever happened before? And in verse 4, he describes what they've just gone through. He writes, after the cutting locusts finished eating the crops, the swarming locusts took what was left. And after them came the hopping locusts, and then the stripping locusts too. Joel is describing a locust plague that Israel had just endured. And this kind of thing did not happen all the time. It was a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and it was an absolute tragedy. I'm sure that the people want to forget about it, but Joel wants them to remember it, to the point where he even says in verse 5, tell your children about it in the years to come. Let your children tell their children. Pass the story down from generation to generation. Joel does not want this locust plague to be forgotten or lost in their memories. If they'd had cameras, Joel would have been saying, take pictures, take videos, do not forget it. Put this in the scrapbook. This was sent for a reason. I remember hearing a story about Dwight D. Eisenhower in the years following World War II. He toured some of the concentration camps in the country of Germany and in Poland. And as he walked around, this is what he said. He said, get it all on record now. Get the films, get the witnesses, because somewhere down the road of history, some bastard will get up and say that this never happened. Excuse my French if you're offended, but you get the point. He wanted it to be remembered. And so does Joel. Joel wants them to remember this plague. Now, we don't know the extent of this locust plague 2,800 years ago. We don't know exactly what it was like, but something very similar happened in March of 1915, just over 100 years ago, in Palestine. Locusts came in. It's described that there were so many locusts that were in the sky that it was so thick it blocked the sun. They would land and each locust would dig a hole 4 inches deep, and in that hole they would lay about 100 eggs in one square yard of soil. 70,000 eggs would be laid, and this would go for miles and miles and miles as far as the eye could see. A few weeks later, after the eggs were laid, they would hatch. The locusts would come up out of the ground and would begin to walk around and eat everything that it could possibly find. After a few more days, they would gain enough strength to begin to hop, and so everything a foot or two off the ground would be devoured. And then they would have wings and they would fly everywhere. And over the course of a few weeks, it looked like a nuclear bomb had gone off. Everything was devoured by these locusts. And this is what the people of Israel endured. This is what Joel is talking about. I imagine when Joel told this to the people, he said, hey, remember this. They said, hey, thanks, Joel, but we don't need the reminder. We don't need the reminder. We know, and we don't want to remember it. I imagine that people died because there was no food for the people. They're going, how could we possibly forget this, Joel? Thanks for bringing it up. How could we forget this, Joel? You know, Joel, being a great prophet, being a great guy, I'm sure, being a voice for God, you would think that he would say something encouraging at this point, like, hang in there, guys, don't worry, it gets better, we're almost to the end of this thing. But instead, Joel says, if you think that was bad, worse is to come if you don't turn from sin. This is just a glimpse of what your life will be like if you do not turn back to God. In the rest of chapter 1, Joel essentially writes, wake up. Wake up. This is not a random natural disaster. This is a taste of what could be ahead for you. God sent this to you as a warning to wake you up. As I say that, I'm just asking you, does that catch you off guard? That God would send a locust plague? Does it prompt you to have questions like, wait a minute. God sent the locust plague? God inflicted the pain? God sent the natural disaster? I thought God was supposed to be good, working out for the good of those who love him. Where does this fit into my picture of God, that he would send something that would kill people like this? And then maybe a question you have is, does God still do that? Does God still send pain or natural disasters? Does he still initiate those kinds of things today? Well, let me answer that question by just saying this. God doesn't destroy, sin destroys. When you understand that, you start to see the earthly consequences of God's judgment as expressions of God's mercy. You see, what God does in our lives is He lets us see where sin has taken us before it's too late. Any experience of the painful consequences of our sin before it's too late is God in mercy and in love trying to wake us up. Here's the big idea for today. God does not try to pay us back for our sin. God tries to bring us back from our sin. A few years ago, maybe some of you guys remember this happening, but there was a website called Ashley Madison. It was a website for married people to create a profile and begin having affairs with other people. Somebody hacked into the website and found all the names and email addresses and released it to the public. And if you remember at that time, there were hundreds, thousands of people that lost their jobs immediately. And there were even a lot of pastors that had created profiles and were having affairs through this Ashley Madison website. There was one pastor specifically that just had a moment of weakness. And truly, he got on there in a moment of weakness and created a profile. Just put his name and his email address in there. Never did anything after that. Never contacted anybody. Never put a picture on there. Never did anything after that. That's all he did. But his name, just like all the others, was released to the public. Now, I'm not defending this person. I'm not saying what he did was right. But what happened to him afterwards seemed to him like an extreme consequence. He lost everything. He was immediately fired from his job. He lost his ministry. He lost his influence. He lost everything. And for 6 months, he just was so bitter towards God. God, how could you let this happen? I didn't even do anything that bad. I didn't even follow through. It just was one small, tiny moment of weakness. I didn't even remember that I did it. This was his attitude towards it. But over the course of 6 months, his heart changed. He realized that the steep consequences of his minor slip was not God's wrath and punishment, but it was actually an expression of God's mercy. And this pastor is quoted as saying this, "Losing my ministry was bad, but it kept me from losing things much worse, my family and my soul." You see, in this moment, God was not trying to pay him back for his sins. God was trying to bring him back from his sins. You see, at times we experience difficulty or trials or roadblocks in our lives, and we want to ask questions about the goodness of God. Where is God, and why in the world could he let this happen to me? You're trying to save money, but things keep breaking down. You try to be better in your marriage, but new issues of conflict come up. You try to find a house, you try to buy a house and you get outbid or your realtor screws it up. You try new strategies to get happier, but it only feels like a skin deep happiness and it doesn't last for very long. You see, God knows that only He can truly satisfy you and give you peace. So at times, God can frustrate our strategies that we think will satisfy us. You see, if we think money or a better marriage or a bigger house or a better spouse or being happy because we look better, if we think that that will finally satisfy us, what's going to happen when we get it and it doesn't? What's going to happen? Where are we going to turn whenever we get what we think that we want and it doesn't satisfy us or give us peace? We'll just turn to the next thing. And God doesn't want that for us. He wants to show himself as the ultimate source of satisfaction and peace. You see, God can frustrate our horizontal strategies to improve our lives because he knows that the problem is not horizontal, it's vertical. And God frustrates our horizontal fixes, not because he's mean, but because he is kind. We sometimes view it like God is, you know, punishing us or casting judgment on us. God is not punishing us. He's taking us to places where we realize the only thing in life that can fulfill us is a true relationship with God. And so God at times will initiate frustration and pain. He will send locusts into your life to wake you up before it's too late to turn to him. And this is not God's wrath on you. This is his mercy in your life. This whole idea begs the question, is there something in your life that you're asking God to take away? Or is there something in your life that you're asking God to fix? Or you're asking God to give you and he won't give it to you? Should you realize instead that God is sending you a warning through this, that God could actually be preventing that from happening because he's trying to wake you up? Because after Joel describes the worst locust plague that had ever hit this nation, that had ravaged their land, he warns them of what is to come if they don't wake up and turn from their sin. In chapter 2, he goes, it will be worse. It will be much worse. Not only in this life, not only earthly, but eternal separation from God will happen if you do not turn from sin. But then, after this warning from Joel, true to character, God gives them an invitation. He gives them this gracious and merciful invitation. His patience does not run out, and he gives them an invitation. Remember what I told you, that the book of Joel is a warning, but the book of Joel is an invitation too. You guys see, God cannot overlook sin, and here's why, because he knows what sin does. Sin separates people from him, and he loves people. And so he can't overlook it as if it doesn't matter. The sin in your life matters to him because it separates you from him. He cares so much. And so God warns them, and sometimes God warns us. Sin will destroy us, both now and forever. God sends the plague to give them a glimpse of what life is like without God. And he sends an invitation. He doesn't leave them up a creek without a paddle. He sends a yacht and drops the ladder and says, hop on board. Look what Joel says in chapter 2, verses 12 through 13. This is what God says. He says, turn to me now while there's still time. Give me your hearts. Come with fasting and weeping and mourning. Don't tear your clothing in grief, but tear your hearts instead. Return to the Lord, your God. He's merciful and compassionate. He's slow to get angry. He's filled with unfailing love. He's eager to relent and not punish. This is the character of God. Can we just stop for a minute? Can we just go back through that a little bit slower? He says, turn to me now while there's still time. God gives them more time. He always seems to just keep giving us more time, more grace. If you're watching this or listening to this right now, you have time to turn to God. But you and I both know that that will not always be the case. We get one life to live and there are no do-overs. You're gonna die and I'm gonna die, and neither of us know when that's gonna happen. What I do know is that right now there's still time to turn to God. I'm not trying to be morbid, I'm trying to be honest that this life doesn't last forever. And the decision of who we're gonna follow in this life is determines where we spend the rest of eternity. And God's saying, turn to me while there is still time. And if you're listening to this or you're watching this, there's still time. Tomorrow isn't guaranteed, so do not wait until you have all the answers. Do not wait until you clean up your life and you feel like you're ready to come back to God. Turn back to God now, because there's still time. What does it look like to turn back to God? He says, give me your hearts. Come with fasting and weeping and mourning. Don't tear your clothing in grief, but tear your hearts instead. You see, in this time period in history, people, when going through tremendous grief or remorse, would physically tear their clothes to show people that they were in mourning. If you saw somebody with their clothes all shredded up, you could imagine that they were going through a very difficult time in their life. But God says, I don't want your torn clothes, I want your heart. I care so much more about the inside than what you're showing to people. In other words, I don't want you to appear like you're following me, I want you to actually follow me. There's a reoccurring in the reminder in the Bible that God constantly speaks to his people. And we need to hear it too, is that God's just saying, I care so much more about the inside than the outside. Man may look at the outward appearance, but God is looking at our hearts. So he's going, don't show me torn clothes, show me your hearts. What does this actually look like? I can remember being a high school student, or even in college, or maybe even more recently, if I'm being honest, where, you know, I go to a church service or a camp or a retreat, and the band starts playing, and your boy, Joel, right here, I'm either in the front row or certainly near it, and right as that first chorus hits, man, my hands are in the air. My eyes are closed. And from time to time, I've been worshiping God with all of my heart in those moments. But more often than I would like to admit, I did it so that somebody else would think I really loved God. I got one eye open. Hey, did that girl notice me? That has happened more times than I would like to admit. That is a great example of somebody or myself just outwardly looking like they're following God, but in my heart, I'm just following myself. I'm hoping that people notice me, not notice God. God's saying, I don't want that. I want you to actually follow me. I want you to obey me. I want you to listen to me. You know, it's a really good question that we ought to ask ourselves. Is there anything that we're doing for God that's really so somebody else will notice us or praise us? And churches, they can be very tricky places for people who love to be noticed. Because on one hand, you should join a team, and you should join a group, and you should bring a meal to somebody, and you should serve at the food drive, and you should do those things, and God loves those things. He loves it when we are the physical representation of service and love to others. That's what we're called to do as Christians. But sometimes, if I take a meal to somebody or help somebody move, I'm not doing it for God, I'm doing it for me. I'm hoping that they think that I'm generous or that I'm kind. Sometimes I will encourage someone, not so that they will feel encouraged, but so that they will think that I'm encouraging. So really, what looks like it's for God is actually for me. It's a tough question, but you should answer it. Is there anything we're doing for God that's really for ourselves? God's going, don't tear your clothes and just do stuff so people see you. I want your hearts. And he makes this final appeal, this final invitation. He says, return to the Lord your God, for he's merciful and compassionate. He's slow to get angry, and he's filled with unfailing love. He's eager to relent and not punish. That's different than the God that has been presented to me sometimes in my life. Isn't it though? Doesn't that describe a different God than you've been led to believe at times, that he's merciful and compassionate and slow to get angry? I feel like sometimes people tell me that God's quick to get angry. He's filled with unfailing love, like it never fails. He's eager to relent and not punish. That is unbelievable. And that's the character of God. Everything that God does comes from a merciful, compassionate, loving, forgiving place. So even the frustration in your life, the pain, the locusts, the earthly consequences for sin, God can allow those into your life and at times even initiate them in your life. He doesn't spare you from all pain. And this isn't the wrath of God. It's the mercy of God being given to you. And somebody needed to hear that today. Turn to God. There's still time. And love God, not just on the outside, but on the inside. Turn to him. And if you forget everything else that this Joel said today, let me just read one more time the words of the prophet Joel as he describes the character of God. Let this sink in. Return to the Lord your God, for he's merciful and compassionate. He's slow to get angry. He's filled with unfailing love. He's eager to relent and not punish. This is our God. I hope that this look into the book of Joel has awakened your heart to how much God loves you. In love, he even warns us from time to time. And at the end of the day, he gives us an invitation. And so while there is still time, I pray that you will return to God. Three Creeks, I love you. We'll see you soon.
Thanks so much for listening. If you're interested in more information about our church, getting connected with a community group, or attending one of our upcoming in-person gatherings, please visit 3creekschurch.com.